Blog Talk Radio.
All right, welcome to Real Sports Guys, where real guys talk real sports. It's your man Marcus, the Game Changer, holding you down. You're joining us tonight, like you always do about this time, Renegade Radio, RSG. We got a banging show lined up for everybody tonight. We have a couple of special guests on deck for you all. The three-man booth is in full effect. We're going to have to roll with two-thirds of the three-man booth tonight. We're going to be missing PhD. He's taking care of some BI, which we all have to do from time to time. So thoughts out to him and his as they handle family business. You know, he's with us in spirit as always. I got my man D. Wills. He's working the back room right now, getting things in order as we get prepared to deliver a slamming show tonight. As we like to say on the Real Sports Guys, RSG Renegade Radio, we keep it provocative because it gets the people going. So I'll give you a quick rundown of what we have for you tonight. Again, we have a jam-packed show. You know, we're trying to follow up last week's effort. You know, it was a great effort last week. We had a lot of tournament coaches on. Gave you a really in-depth look into some of our sleeper teams in the tournament, talking to some coaches from VCU, UNC Asheville, amongst others. We also had a tremendous moment for the RSG team. We had Brett Bielema, University of Wisconsin football head coach, on the show. He shared some thoughts with us about this past season for the Badgers, and he also talked about the upcoming spring and preparation for next season. So, again, a landmark show for us last week, and we want to keep that going as we continue to step our game up and bring you all sports from a real perspective. Now, tonight's show, we have an interview with Coach Nagy from San Diego State will be joining us tonight. South Dakota State, my bad. The South Dakota State Jackrabbits, which were just eliminated, unfortunately, from the NCAA tournament. He's going to talk with us. He's going to join us. We're going to reflect on the Jackrabbits tournament experience. So we're going to touch base with Coach Nagy on that. We're also going to get into the funky editorial. We're going to talk a little Peyton Manning. We're going to get into five on the black hand side. And we're going to talk about what we like to call around these parts basketball Christmas, which is the first weekend of the NCAA tournament. Tons of games, tons of action, tons of things to get into and discuss. We're going to get into all of that in the five on the black hand side. From there, our second guest of the evening is going to join us after we get into our Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Ramogi Huma is going to join us. He is a member of the National College Players Association, or the founder of the National College Players Association. He's going to join us tonight around 10 o'clock. So stay tuned for that, and then we're going to go into shutdown mode as we get ready to creep into the after-hour section of the show. So again, hang on with us. Hang tight. Before we get into all of that, though, you know, we got to kind of let everything settle in before we get Coach Nagy on. It's been a whirlwind week. It's been a whirlwind week in sports. The tournaments is in full swing. We're at the Sweet 16 right now. You know, a lot of action, a lot of upsets, which is wonderful for the tournament. It gives some programs that don't usually get a lot of publicity and don't usually have a high profile during the season an opportunity to showcase their style of basketball, showcase the players on their team and their university and their university communities. With that, I want to bring in, I want to introduce real quick my man D. Wills. D. Wills, you there?
Yes.
Holler at the people, man.
Well, you know, I'm excited about the show tonight. I think it's incredible. You know, we'll have Coach Nagy on, and I mean, it's an incredible run for this program. If you think they've only realize they've only been in Division I at this level for short seasons, and it takes a leader to kind of get a program to the point where they're at right now. And so we're excited about that. And, you know, we had a great interview with Coach Klinkerfis, but to know that we have a chance to talk to the person who's spearheaded this rise is exciting. And, you know, and talk about what's happening with the tournament and then also talk about, you know, Inside the Park, which is our new show coming out tomorrow night, and to have a couple of our co-hosts on with that. So we're excited to get this show up and running.
Yes, we are. So without any further ado, I'd like to bring in South Dakota State Jackrabbits head coach Scott Nagy. Coach Nagy, are you there?
I'm here.
How you doing tonight, Coach?
Very good. We're on our one of my assistants, we're on our way over to the Minnesota State Tournament.
All right. Doing a little recruiting?
Always doing recruiting. It never ends.
Absolutely. So, Coach, again, thank you for joining us. It's a great honor and privilege to have you on with us right now. We really appreciate you taking the time out to spend some time with us. As we begin to get into our conversation here, the first question I'd like to touch base with you on is really quickly, you know, you guys are unfortunately you had the misfortune of facing a really tough Baylor team in the first round, a team that seems to be on the upswing, starting to get hot. They have a ton of talent, a ton of potential. And, you know, they've kind of been an up-and-down team all season, and you seem to catch them on the upswing. You played them extremely tough, took them down to the wire. Why don't you talk a little bit about some of the preparation, how you got your guys prepared to face a team that has a level of athleticism that you may not get to see on a day-to-day basis in the Summit Conference?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, we don't normally see people like Baylor that have that kind of length and that kind of athleticism. The only team that we played this year that we could compare with that was the University of Washington, who you know had a couple of McDonald's All-Americans and some very good basketball players, and we went into Washington and beat them 19 this year and played very well, shot the ball well. Nate Walters, our star point guard, I think had 34 points and 7 assists and no turnovers in that game, and so that was the only thing we really had to compare it to. But at the same point, Washington still doesn't even match up with Baylor in terms of athleticism. And I think when everybody talks about Baylor, they talk about their length, and they are clearly one of the longest, tallest teams that I've ever seen. But their best players are their guards. Pierre Jackson and Heslop are by far their best players. They're the ones that hurt us. You know, we had to focus on the inside because we're just not nearly as big, and so we had to make sure that we shut that down. And we did a great job of that. Defensively, we played well enough to win the game. Offensively, we didn't. We didn't shoot the ball well enough. We made mistakes that we normally don't make, and it cost us. You know, we're one of the top teams in the nation in terms of turnovers per game. We had 13 in that game. We usually average around 10. And those things cost us. We made 10 threes, but we need to make about 12 or 13, and we could have won the basketball game.
So what were some of the messages that you gave your team as you guys began to prepare, you know, this being the program's first trip to the NCAA tournament? You know, you guys have only been in Division I for a short period of time. You know, this was a landmark year for you guys to get into the tournament. How did you begin to prepare your players for the level of intensity that, they were going to experience as they began to play their first tournament game?
Well, the way, you know, having coached the kids all year, I knew that they wouldn't be afraid. You know, they weren't going to go into the game and be nervous and think that we can't play with them. We have a very confident group. We've been very good offensively all year. You know, the question for us was, you know, can we guard them? Because we feel like we can score on them. And we did guard them. We didn't score on them enough. But, you know, it wasn't like I had to change the way that I coach in order to make sure that our guys were ready to play. I knew that they would be confident. The one thing here at the end of the year that we just kept telling our guys, the message we gave them was to play like you're loved, which basically meant that you know that the people close to you already love you, and so you don't have to perform well in order for those people to care about you because they already care about you. And so it frees you up to play your very best. And so we just kept telling them, play like you loved. You know, and at the end of the year, we did. I thought that our kids did. It obviously got us into the tournament. And, you know, even though we didn't play great against Baylor, we competed. And quite honestly, the way we, in terms of how good we played, we could have gotten beat 30. But the one thing we didn't do is quit. And it kept us in that game. And it gave us a chance, even with a minute to go, we had the ball down 4. And so we were in that game for sure.
So, you know, I totally agree with you. You guys were in the game until the end. Again, it was a tremendous season for you all, and kind of a season that I think can mark a turning point for a program in your situation. What are some things that you all as coaches can take away from the turning experience and begin to use as building blocks for the coming years with your South Dakota State program?
Well, it's really more what the players can take away from it, because our kids, after having been to the NCAA tournament, clearly think differently. And, you know, they got a taste of that. They want to go back to it. We're in a league, in a summit, that we know that you have to basically win our league tournament in order to go. And so it doesn't matter how good a year you have all year. And like this year, Oral Roberts had just a tremendous year. They won the league. They went 17-1. They get beat in the tournament. They don't go. You know, so we know it comes down to 3 games in March. But our kids got a taste of it. I think their expectations are higher. I think the way that they'll talk to each other and the way they'll push each other will be different. I think that when recruits come in, when our new recruits come in this year, you know, they'll be told by our players that these are the expectations, this is what we want done. And so it's really nice as a coach when you finally get a group of kids to that level, then – You're not the one that always has to be sending the message, because your kids do. Now, certainly, I can't guarantee that it will help recruiting, but it isn't going to hurt it. We know that. We know that. And actually, I know that it's helped, because we've already gotten a commitment from a kid just the day after the tournament. And so, you know, things are already rolling there. We still have a couple scholarships left, and plus we'll be able to do the early recruiting next year. And so we have a chance, really, to pick up 2 classes here coming off this NCAA tournament.
Okay. Now, you're kind of rolling right along with me as we begin to talk about, you started to talk about recruiting. Can you share some insight into the nuances of recruiting at the mid-major level? It's a very different animal than what Coach Cal at Kentucky gets to do, or Coach K at Duke gets to do. Can you talk about how do you guys go out and find kids who fit into what you do with your program?
Well, and that's the key for us, is making sure that the players are good fits. And that's not easy to do, because you may take somebody that's not as talented but is a better fit, and in the end will be a better player for you. And you know, it's always hard to project those things. That's not an easy thing to do. And I think sometimes, like you say, Coach Cal, I mean, he's just going to go out and get the very best players he can get, which we know we can't do. And so we have to do a better job of finding kids that fit a system and can play within that system and then can develop within that system. Because for us, that's one of the most important things, is how does a player develop? And so we, you know, obviously our kids stay around the summer. They're with us pretty much 10 months a year. And the player development side for us is probably the most important thing. It's not just going out and getting this high major talent that's already coming out of high school and is a great player. It's being able to take a kid that you still see has a ton of potential, develop that potential, and then when they're juniors and seniors, that's why you look at teams like ours that are mid-major programs can play with some of these major programs, because the major programs generally are playing a lot of young kids, where in our instance, we're generally not. Now, we only had one senior on our basketball team, and so obviously the future looks very good for us. But, you know, the good mid-major teams generally have juniors and seniors that are running those teams, and the player development is probably the most important thing that we do.
Now, you're talking about player development. You guys have obviously invested a lot in developing Nate Walters, and he obviously has invested a ton in himself. He's performed at an extremely high level for you guys all season. Can you talk a little bit about his impact on your program as a leader and as kind of your go-to guy?
Yeah, well, you know, getting Nate, when we recruited Nate 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago now, it was really a turning point for us, obviously. Now, I think sometimes coaches fool themselves and think that they're great coaches. The fact of the matter is, when you have great players, you're a great coach, and when you don't, you're not. And I understand that. And so the most important thing you can do is recruit good players and good talent. You know, and Nate was one of those kids who was very under-recruited. Mostly Division II schools were recruiting him. We got involved with him early. He didn't sign early, but he did sign with us late in April after his senior year. And we knew we had a good player. Most people recruited him as a kind of a combo guard, play the one and the two. We told him we wanted him to be our point. We didn't want him to do anything else but be our point. And he's obviously turned into a great player. He's going to be the best player as long as he stays healthy. He'll be the best player that ever played at South Dakota State. And he's going to be the all-time leading scorer, probably the all-time leader in assists. And he's done it against the best talent we've ever played against, because most of the record holders we have come from the Division II era. So he's been a huge turnaround. Now, we've added good classes behind him that have been very good, but it really started with getting Nate. And when you have a good point guard, when you have somebody that you can put the ball in his hands, trust that good things are going to happen, and they generally do when Nate has it, it's a great start. And then we've been able to surround him with really, really good shooters. And so it's made it difficult for teams to guard him, because if they really focus on him, then he's able to pass the ball and we're able to shoot it. So, playing with Nate, I think, has made these guys better shooters. And then these really good shooters have helped Nate, because it's opened up the floor for Nate, and then he's able to get to the basket.
All right. So, you know, coming off this tremendous season for the program, what do you think are some keys to taking that next step and continuing to put yourself in the class of some of the more branded mid-major programs such as Butler, VCU, or Gonzaga? What are some things that you need to do, or what are some key things that need to happen at South Dakota State with the Jackrabbit program to kind of put yourself in that category as a regular in the tournament, a name that people know, a name that's respected? What do you think you're going to need to do to continue to build towards establishing yourself as a year-in, year-out tournament team?
Well, that's certainly our goal, and I think, even as you look at Butler this year, at that level, it is very, very, very difficult to stay at a very high level, because you generally run through a class or two of good kids, and then it's hard to recruit kids because they're not going to play there. And so you kind of have cycles, and it's very difficult for the mid-majors to stay at a very high level. And so, but when you look at Butler and Gonzaga, some of those people you mentioned, that certainly would be the goal for us. And the main thing in doing that is recruiting, is that you recruit good players in every class. And, you know, when you finally get to that point, and this is the tough part, I think, for kids, because most kids coming out of high school now want to play when they're freshmen. They want to be an impact player when they're freshmen. They look at Kentucky. The fact of the matter is that most mid-major programs, their impact players are not freshmen. They're juniors and seniors. And when you've established and built a really good program, that is generally the way it goes. If freshmen come in and learn, they either redshirt or they learn, they sit. Their sophomore year, they play some and get some feel. Their junior and senior year, they become the stars. And that's what has to happen at South Dakota State, and that's what's starting to happen. We're starting to really build some depth and put some good classes together. But certainly that would be the goal. And some people look at it and say, well, how are you going to do that at South Dakota State? And my whole thought process is, why not? We're not looking at why we can't do something. We're trying to figure out why we can do it.
Excellent. That's about the time we have. I want to be respectful of your time, Coach. I appreciate you coming on. And, you know, we here at A Real Sports Guys and the RSG crew, we think that you guys are a team to watch. We want to continue to have you all on as your program continues to develop and become a higher profile program. We see a lot of good things for you guys down the road. So we just want to thank you for coming on, and we appreciate you taking the time out to spend some time with us here at Real Sports Guys.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you having me on, too. Thank you very much.
All right, take care, Coach.
Okay.
Great interview with Coach Nagy there. Coach Scott Nagy, South Dakota State Jackrabbits. You know, that's a team that, again, has just kind of stepped into the Division I ranks and has really begun to establish a name for themselves. They played Baylor extremely tough. Again, Baylor is one of those teams that it was a team that I felt like they could beat. I definitely felt like that was a team that they can get. Again, Baylor's been up and down, a bit Jekyll and Hyde-ish all season. Coach Nagy talked about that a little bit and how, you know, Baylor was a level of athleticism that they don't get to see very often. You know, and the closest comparison they had was a game with Washington. But I like what they're doing out there. I like the style that they play. You know, they're coming along nicely. And they're really, really bringing the level of that program up. And I think we're going to see them begin to make some good runs into the tournament in the next couple of years. They had a shot this year. You know, some of the interesting pieces that Coach Nagy laid on us was the recruiting piece. That's a very different game when you're a mid-major and you're going out looking for kids. In comparison to some of the high majors and the way that they can go out and kind of show up and have a kid's interest, you really have to be able to sell yourself at the mid-major level. And I think Coach Nagy has done that. And you got to kind of find kids that fit with your system, that can play a role in your program, that can fulfill a need for you guys to be successful. And I think one of the benefits of being at a mid-major is you know you're going to have kids for, you know, 3 to 4 years, you know. Easy. You can always count on having kids for 3 to 4 years when you're playing at a mid-major program or when you're coaching at a mid-major program. D. Wills, did you have an opportunity to catch any of Coach Nagy's interview? I know you you were in the back room working things out. You know, D. Wills is behind the scenes. He's like the mechanic right now. He's in the back. He's under the car. He's making sure everything is running right. Insight.
Yeah, you know I'm all sport. You know, I think and when Coach Klinkefist, his assistant, was on with us as we prepared for the tournament, he was, you know, he talked a lot about Coach Nagy. And as you listen to Coach Nagy, you get a sense of why his program's performing. I mean, you have to think about it. This program was Division II not too long ago. And in a short period of time, they have begun to put their program on the map. And to think about the kind of work, and, you know, they really have found pockets of talent in the Midwest, working, you know, Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota, South Dakota, and really kind of finding their pockets of talent and molding it the way they can. And then, you know, everyone, you get a guy like Walters, you know, who can kind of do it all. That takes it to the next level, but you understand why they're successful. And again, I think what's great about this is getting behind the recruiting philosophy. There's many different ways to build a winner, but you have to start with a philosophy, and it's clear that they have a vision of how they want to build the program, and they're committed to it.
Absolutely, absolutely. So now, Real Sports Guys, we're going to begin the transition. We're going to bring in some special guests that we have for you tonight. I'm going to let D. Wills kind of get them kind of introduce the next step in the evolution of the Real Sports Guys Renegade Radio format. D. Wills, take it away.
Well, thank you, Game Changer. You know, I'm excited about it. This is, you know, the last month or so for our show has been incredible. You know, before I get into this, I do want to make sure I take a shout out, yell out to one of our newest RSG fans, Danny Curtis, who is listening in for the first time tonight. He's a big Badger fan, and so he's a young man in Jamesville. I want to give him a shout out. But we're adding more to the team. You know, we talked about the Wu-Tang philosophy. We're adding, and we've been talking about this concept of this baseball show, Inside the Park, and many of you have heard R.J. Page on the show. You know that this guy is incredible in terms of his knowledge around baseball. He's been on talking about it, and he's been one of the catalysts behind it. But the folks that we have with us tonight, the co-hosts for Inside the Park, which will be on Wednesday nights, 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern, are going to be on with us tonight. We have Hank Davis and Michael Bailey. What's up? How you doing, fellas? Welcome to the show. These cats, I've been listening to them prepare for this, and this crew is going to be incredible. They're going to add a lot. Hank, I'm going to start with you. I think we're going to flip the question a little bit and kind of start with what the people can expect from the show. And talk a little bit about, you know, what you think you're going to bring in, what they can expect for the show from Inside the Park if they listen in on Wednesday nights.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on tonight. What you're going to hear from the show is you're going to hear baseball from all kind of different perspectives. You mentioned RJ earlier. He's very, very knowledgeable in regards to stats and stuff. I think I bring a more of a real fan perspective. I think, you know, just a fan on steroids, if you will, that, you want to know what's happening. You really know the game. But in the same token, it's more of that fan, you know, let's get to the real meat and potatoes of baseball, you know, what baseball is all about. And so I think that's what the fans are the folks that's going to listen to. They're going to really enjoy baseball talk from all different type of perspectives.
And the one thing I think the folks will understand, Hank is going to bring that, for you longtime listeners, Hank might bring some Ray flavor to it. And, so the longtime listeners, you might not know what's going to come out of Hank's mouth out of the show, but I've known Hank for a long time, and you're going to bring some crazy energy to the show. So I know that. Michael, we're going to bring you on. What do you feel like you bring into the show, and you know, what do you hope will happen with the show?
Thanks for having me, Andy. So, first of all, I think we're all excited to get the show on the road here. This is the best sporting time of year, no doubt about it. You've got baseball coming up with spring training, the tournament. You got the draft, NFL 24/7 out. It's just a great time of year. For me, just getting started with the baseball season is absolutely fantastic. And for everybody out there, you know, what I like to think about it between Hank, RJ, and I, it's three guys just discussing baseball. You know, just like you're at the bar talking it out. And if someone's bringing the wrong stuff, we'll call it out right there. But you know, from my perspective, you know, I'm your conspiracy theory guy. I'm your big issue guy. We're going to talk about why Pittsburgh's no good and why New York's always good. And we're going to tell, you know, how we feel. We're going to speak from our hearts. And sometimes you don't necessarily feel you're going to get the smartest argument out there, but you're going to get a real argument out there. So we're going to have fun. And like I said, we may not always be right, but we're going to have fun.
Well, you guys, I mean, you're in the midst of, you know, getting ready for the baseball season. A lot of times we always have the discussion about if you had a chance to start a team, you know, you can play GM, right? And if you have a chance to play GM, if Hank, I'll start with you. If you were starting a team right now, looking at the current players we have in Major League Baseball, who would you start a team with?
Oh, that's easy. It's Matt Kemp with the L.A. Dodgers, the center fielder. You know, should have been MVP, in my opinion, in the last year. A five-tool player, exciting to watch, can bang the baseball, can get on base, can play defense. You want to start in the middle of the diamond. And he's a player to start with. You know, we've been going back and forth on that as we was preparing for the show. But I said, you know, for tonight, I'm going to come correct.
So you start with Matt Kemp. That's where
right.
You're going to start with. Michael, who are you going to start with?
Man, that's a dime a dozen pick, Matt Kemp. That's just for 1 year, Hank's going to start his franchise with him. Go figure. Man, I got some stock tips for you. You can invest with me. It's good. You know, I'm going to go a different direction. To me, the most important thing, I look at what the most valuable commodity is in baseball these days. And for me, there's no doubt about it, that is a quality young ace that's got some innings under his belt. He's healthy. He's shown that he's durable. And for me, that's Felix Hernandez. He's been doing it for 6 years, over 200 innings a year, got a 3.5 ERA in the American League. And I tell you what, if it's not working out for you and I had to trade him at midseason, I could get a King's ransom for him at any point. So that's where I'm starting. I think everybody needs that hammer number one, that you're going to be a great team. And I don't think there's anybody else out there who's doing it better at his age than Felix Hernandez.
Now, I didn't prep you guys on this question, but we got a little bit of time here. I'm just going to ask this. If you look at, like, you know, some early favorites for, you know, World Series, and I know you'll talk a little bit about it, but if you think about teams that you feel like are on the way up, and, Michael, I'll go with you, teams that you think have a chance to make some noise outside of some of the obvious ones, but who are you thinking is going to make some noise this year that most folks might not be thinking about?
That's a good one. So when you ask that question, I think about teams that, you know, maybe finished under 500 last year, maybe historically, you know, last couple of years haven't been there. You know, I'm looking in the American League for a team like the Toronto Blue Jays, sitting, I think, just two games under 500 last year. They got a lot of young talent. They got some good pitching up there. And to be just under 500 in the AL East is absolutely fantastic. So, you know, I think if they can get some of their younger players to continue to produce, along with Bautista over there, Ricky Romero, they're going to do just fine. If you look in the National League, the National League is a kind of if you like diversity, the National League definitely has it for you. There's just not as many powerhouse teams up there that are dominating with payroll. So you've got a lot more chance to jump up and be a playoff team. So, you know, just a couple off the top of my head there, I think Cincinnati for sure has got a real nice shot to do some damage. And then the NL East, where I think you're starting to have a void in leadership with the Phillies coming back to the pack, you know, the Braves looking okay, but you've got a chance for Miami to come up and do some damage, as well as Washington. You know, and there's a team that's never been in the playoffs. So it'll be an exciting year, especially in the National League. Look for a couple teams, probably two, that didn't make it last year to come in and, you know, start the party up in the playoffs this year.
Hank, from the regular guy's perspective, from the real guy's perspective.
I'm going to tell you
right now. Tell me who
you're going to tell you.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm sick of Mike talking about Washington. Okay, they've been talking about Washington like they're the second coming. That team sucks. Okay, and they're gonna suck this year, and they're gonna suck next year. They have been talking about Washington. They spent all last week's prep talking about a 19-year-old kid. They suck. They are not winning nothing this year. Now, if you want to talk about teams that's gonna come this year, it might do something. Miami is a sexy pick. They spent some money. They got new unis. They got a World Series winning manager. They're a sexy pick. Okay, in the American League, you're not going to have a whole lot of moving around. You're not. You got two tough teams in the West, in the Angels and in the Rangers. Okay, you got the Tigers that's going to run away in the Central. If I have to pick a team that we ain't talked about that might make some noise as a surprise, it's the Kansas City Royals. They're a young team, they're an up-and-coming team, and they're going to sneak up on some folks. So that's my pick. But y'all, we're going to get off the Nationals. I'm tired of talking about them.
Now, that hurts. Now, if the Nationals got no shot, the Royals, man, how can they do anything when they're in AAA? They've been demoted to AAA.
Oh,
how are they going to do anything?
Here we go. And we got a 19-year-old kid with the Nationals that we've been talking about for 3 weeks. I had to go look him up, and he was still in high school. I'm tired.
Oh, my gosh.
We're not going with the Nationals no more.
Well, guys, I love this energy. And folks, this is what we're talking about. I've been listening to these guys. I've been laughing like this. We're going to have a hot show Wednesday night, 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern. Hey, fellas, give us a party shot. Mike, give us a party shot before you get out of here.
Hey, it's thanks for having me on again. Can't wait to get the show started tomorrow. And just looking forward to a great season. You know, it's baseball time. It's a great time of year.
All right. Hank, say something to the people.
I echo that. It you guys are going to have a lot of fun listening to us. You know, we are some huge, huge baseball fans. Yeah, it's right around the corner. You know, the smell is in the air. You know, and it's time to play ball.
There we go, y'all. Inside the Park, RSG going to the next level. You heard it right here. This is going to be a hot show. This is one of them diamond in the roughs, y'all. If y'all have any thought about baseball, or if you're just a casual fan, you can already tell I'm laughing. I'm going to be in on it. I'm feeling good about it. And we got some great guys here, and looking forward to launching this new show. Back to you, Game Changer.
All right. Man, these cats are about to get at each other. I like it. I like it. Go for the jugular right off the top. That's a preview for it. That's the way to preview your show, man. So everybody be looking out for that. Inside the Park, Wednesday nights. Check it out. It's going to be sounds like it's going to be a knock 'em down, drag 'em out type of event. So we're going to keep a lookout for that. Right now, we're going to get into the funky editorial here at the Real Sports Guys, like we always do about this time. So I'm going to go ahead and get that rolling, and then we'll jump into it.
Fellas, one thing we need to say. Shall we say it, y'all? Melvin,
right.
Jimmy, Coleman, Ryan, say it.
Yeah.
Everybody want to get funky one more time.
So, the Real Sports Guys, we like to editorialize on a lot of things related to sports. We're going to continue with that tradition. This week has been a big week in sports overall. So it was really hard to hone in on one particular thing that we wanted to focus on as we did our usual prep over the weekend. And then yesterday the universe just pointed us in the right direction and gave us something to roll with and made that decision for us. And how that decision was made was a prominent NFL quarterback made his decision and decided what team he was going to be playing with after touring around the country and having some teams come visit him. Peyton Manning, yesterday around, I don't know, about 10, 11 o'clock, finally made a decision as to where he was going to play football, which is a big story in itself. It's a major story in itself. For those that have been living under the proverbial rock for the last 5 to 6 months, Peyton Manning has been injured, missed all of last season with a neck injury, an injury that was speculated to be career-threatening or at least would change his effectiveness on the field if he were to play again. He had 4 surgeries on his neck. He turns 36 in a couple of weeks. And the Indianapolis Colts suffered through a 1-win season where they were awarded the first pick in the NFL draft in a year where what is viewed as a once-in-a-generation quarterback prospect is available. As all this is playing out, they have a decision to make. The Colts, the Indianapolis Colts, the organization has a decision to make as to whether or not to pay Peyton Manning a $28 million bonus that he would be due if they were to keep him on their roster. Which is a hell of a decision. All things considered, you know, 4 neck surgeries, 36-year-old quarterback, with a once-in-a-generation QB prospect out there as the anointed number one pick in the draft, and you happen to hold the number one pick. So that's where the Colts were. Earlier this month, they decided to finally release Peyton. They let Peyton go. And then Peyton went on a tour to figure out where he was going to be next. He went out. He talked with the Denver Broncos. He talked with the Arizona Cardinals. He went back home to Tennessee where he played his college ball. He touched base there, all the while trying to figure out where was going to be the best place for him to finish out and begin to write the final chapter of his immaculate career. A couple days went by, a couple weeks went by. You know, Adam Schefter's running around doing his Schefty thing. Chris Mortensen's running around doing his Mort thing. Adrian Wojnarowski's running around doing his Woj thing. And all these prominent internet writers are out there trying to figure out where is Peyton Manning going to wind up. They're all out there trying to predict where he's going to end up. The 49ers throw their hat into the ring late in the game. And they seem like that they were going to be the team to pick him up after adding a Randy Moss, Mario Manningham, having the league's best defense, a solid run game, a solid offensive line, and an excellent coach. Seemed like that was where he was going to wind up. And then at the last moment, with 2 minutes on the clock, John Elway turned the keys in his car, got the engine started, and went on another drive. And he brought Peyton Manning home. But not only did he bring Peyton Manning home by getting Peyton to commit to come and play for the Denver Broncos, he ended Tebow Mania. And that's where we are today. So the Real Sports Guys, we're going to give our opinions on the Peyton Manning saga. This is like the Lord of the Rings. It's been a long go of it, trying to figure out where Peyton is going to end up. It's somewhat overshadowed basketball Christmas, also known as the NCAA Championship Tournament. It's somewhat overshadowed it, but it hasn't taken away from it. So with that said, D. Wills, what do you make of the Peyton saga?
Well, it was good for football, and it tells you how powerful the brand of the NFL is. And it also provided you with the dark side of football, that at the end of the day, it's a business. I mean, if you think about this, Tebow Mania took over. It was, no pun intended, but it was a religious experience in a sense that it was just this emotion that was going. And the irony of it is it wasn't anything he was really trying to drive. He was just being himself. And how you're not talking about more than, 3 months after NFL season is done. It's like over that quick. It tells you how you know, this is really a business. And at the end of the day, there are certain things that NFL folks think win. And, you know, people who know that are good. I remember John Elway said, Tebow had those great comebacks. And what did John Elway say? You know, I really pay attention to third down conversions. You remember that?
Yeah.
You know, that was he was already creating his out clause, right? He was that this is good, but to win championships, you got to be able to convert on third down. And so he was already creating a narrative that was going to get him out. But at the end of the day, when you think about Peyton's journey and everything else, there were a whole bunch of people in it. But at the end of the day, Peyton made a decision that is Peyton Manning type of decision. He tried to align with people who he thought were smart football people, people who probably had a shared view of the game, people who had a solid reputation for pushing things forward and wanting to win. And I think when you look at all the scenarios, there was always something else in those other scenarios that he couldn't really trust. Whether it wasn't quite sure his relationship with the head coach was going to go, it wasn't quite sure that they had enough of the players around to make things go, or he wasn't quite sure the ownership was committed to winning. But if you looked at Denver was the one place that kind of had all three of those things in place. And it just in the end made sense. So this thing has just been quite a roller coaster ride. But I think if you think about it, and this is what LeBron can learn from this, is that he didn't treat it like it was a decision, right? He didn't have a big press conference in the sense that I'm going to announce like this one. He basically was like, Alex Schefter says, Manny says, make the deal with Denver Broncos. That's all you heard. And he moved on. And so I think players can learn from this. We're going to talk about Dwight Howard. Stars can learn from how you can handle this kind of high-profile situation and come out still smelling like a rose. I think in the end, I don't know what it's going to mean, and we can talk about that, but I think it just raised so many different issues.
Yeah. The first thing I want us to get into is, was this the best decision? You know, he had a couple different places that he could have wound up. I felt like from a simple on-field perspective, San Francisco made the most sense, just given what's there. Having brought in a Randy Moss, a Mario Manningham to add to a Michael Crabtree and a Vernon Davis, plus you got Frank Gore in the backfield and a really strong offensive line, a good head coach. And then the number one defense in the league, a returning number one defense in the league. That seemed like that was a ready-made deal. Now, again, if you're Peyton Manning, you, that may not mean a whole lot to you because, you know, you are Peyton Manning and, you know, you played for a franchise in the Indianapolis Colts that every year was in it, and the one year you didn't play, they wasn't in it. You know, so you may feel like, hey, I could take any team in this league and make them to a contender because when the Colts didn't have me, how many games did they win? You know, so maybe that's the perspective Peyton took. Peyton had the opportunity to go back home and basically become a god in the state of Tennessee. You know, he already has, you know, superhero, superhuman-like legend in the state of Tennessee. Had he had gone to the Titans, again, I don't think the football situation was as good as San Francisco or as good as Denver. But as far as kind of being that place where you write that storybook ending to a career, it had all the makings of being able to provide him with that kind of fade off into the sunset and forever be a king kind of moment. Then you had places like Miami, where a very different kind of environment. It seems to be the it place to go right now. A decent football situation, again, I would say it's probably on par with Tennessee and less on par with the Denver situation and the San Francisco situation as far as what possibly could be put on the field, as far as what would be around Peyton Manning. But then there's also that idea of an elevated presence. And I think the additional media attention that would have come with being in Miami, being in the middle of the action, you know, with the LeBrons and with the Miami Marlins and all the moves that they've made, you know, he would have been in the mix and constantly in that conversation as far as one of the more popular. And he already is a big name in sports, but even raising his profile even more by being in Miami and making Miami kind of really the place to be for sports. And then you have Denver. Now, you know, Denver seemed to be a balance. Slightly bigger market than maybe a Tennessee. Better football, just as good a football situation as San Francisco. Then there's that one key element that I think is what really swayed Peyton Manning, and that's the presence of John Elway. What role do you think John Elway's presence played in getting Manning to sign with Denver?
Two things. Someone who has clear control of the organization. Someone who's clear has clear control of the organization. Someone who was an elite quarterback, and someone who won two Super Bowls at the same stage in his career. So he has someone that he can, right now, he can be on the phone and they're talking strategy. Right? It is like Zen-like. So I think for him, that was very important because, like anyone else, he's very much a creature of habit. And Elway would understand that. And Elway's going to do everything to create that environment for him there. And I think those things weren't available as much in other places and could be delivered with the kind of certainty that were important to Peyton Manning. Now, I don't think he has the divisional advantage that he would have had in some of these other locations, because I think that Oakland is going to be more formidable than people think. I think San Diego is going to bounce back. I think Kansas City is not going to be bad. So I think that division is going to be much tougher role than he anticipates than the other options that he had. But I think that if he's going to roll the dice, I think what Elway played is just that role that he knew. He knows Elway's word is going to be the final call in that organization. And he knows that Elway is the one person throughout this entire process who really understands what he's dealing with at this point in his career.
Yeah, I agree. I think Elway was able to go in and have a conversation that no one else was. He could put up that crystal ball in front of Peyton and say, you know, this is what this can look like. I know things that I wanted at this point in my career. I know where you are at this point in your career. I've been there. I understand it. I can help you get the things that I wish I had when I was at this moment in my career. And really able to put up that crystal ball and hold that up to Peyton and say, you know, we can make this happen for you. I think that stability for Peyton is a huge deal. Now, the other side of this coin, you know, we need to put on a little black, you know, get pastor to say a few words as we lay to rest the phenomena known as Tebow Mania. We can lay it down next to Beanie Babies. We can lay it down next to Billy Blanks and Tybo. We can lay it down next to the Teletubbies and Barney. We can lay it down next to Jerry Curls. We can lay it down next to the 8-track. And we can truly consider it a thing of the past. Or can we? Is Tebow Mania done? Or will this come back to haunt us? Is the question I ask right now. I believe that it is done. That is my assessment of the situation. And I will say I believe it's done because of for the following reasons. Tim Tebow, not because he can't be a quarterback, not because he needs his own system. I think those issues are overrated. I think Tim Tebow is done in the NFL for the same reason that he became a megastar, his fans. His fans are crazy. His fans are irrational about his talent and his abilities. They don't have perspective on what he can do as an NFL quarterback. And honestly, it's like bringing the tea party with you. You don't want these cats showing up at your games because they have their own agenda, which is not related to the success of your team. They want to see one player succeed, and that doesn't work in football. And to me, that is what is ultimately going to hurt Tim Tebow is his fans, because no ownership team, no marketing team can risk bringing him in and submarining every other facet of their team because the fan base is solely bent on seeing this kid be successful. It's hard to develop a team in football around one guy, and one guy with an army of irrational, outspoken people who will create controversy and bring controversy where there shouldn't be controversy, where a rational football fan will say, no, our backup needs to stay our backup. If your backup is Tim Tebow, you're asking for trouble. And because of that, I don't think he's at a point in his career where he can be a starter. He can't run a conventional system right now. Can he in the future? I think he can. But I don't think his fans will allow him the time to sit back, learn, and develop the way he should. What do you think? Is Tebow Mania dead?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at how quick this thing turned, I mean, and I don't know if you hear that much of an uprising in Denver. I mean, just Maddie just smashed. Even the report was even Tebow when he talked to Elway, it's Peyton Manning. I think it depends on where he lands. You know, if he lands in Jacksonville, you know, or somewhere in Florida where he has, you know, support, it could, but it's not going to be at the rock star level it was last year. I just think incredible circumstances that allow for it to happen. And, you know, I think the hard part is that, you know, teams have to decide whether or not how they're going to bring him in. And, you know, you could probably bring him in as someone who's going to be a project, but you can't because people have already seen what he's done. And those fans who are crazy about him will march to Jacksonville to say, you know, he needs to be starting. And so I just think the hard thing is about there will be no GMs who want to do this. If this is a if someone gets Tebow, it's an owner's decision. There's no GM who wants to touch this. So you know if the only person who could actually do it successfully and get away with it is Belichick. That's the only person that has a cachet, and because you have Brady to kind of bring him in, or you know, there were some reports that, you know, Green Bay. It has to be one of those situations where it's just so clear that he's going to be a project person that everybody just knows it, that the starting quarterback is just so great that it's not even an issue. I think that's the only way that someone might bring him in, but I don't think it's going to be at the level that it was. I think it's dead, and I don't think it's going to be at the level. And part of it is that there's no GM who wants to touch this. And unless there's an owner who's going to just override, there's no GM that wants to touch it.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you are, man. I don't think that there's an owner out there that really wants to touch this issue. And again, I think people are overplaying the idea that, oh, well, he can't be your backup because he needs his own offense. You can have him as a backup, and you can teach him what you want him to run. Is it going to take him a moment to get it? Heck yeah. Would he work in New England? Possibly. You know, you could find some. The thing about it is, you know, people say, well, send him to a team like New England or Green Bay, and I could see that happening. The thing is that, again, if the coach just needs to temper himself, and don't take out Aaron Rodgers to put Tim Tebow under center. Don't do that. Okay. At no point in the game should you take out Aaron Rodgers or Tom Brady to put Tim Tebow under center. Now, if you're going to split him out wide, if you're going to put him in the backfield behind your starting quarterback, then you do that. But at no point should Aaron Rodgers or Tom Brady ever come out of the game in favor of Tim Tebow. As long as they got breath in their chest, you leave them out there. I don't care if you got to wheel them out there. You leave them out there. All right? You got to leave them out there.
But let me say this though, I think if you could create a slash type of mentality for him, what the great thing that happened with Slash was that it created extra work for the defense. Now Pittsburgh might have had four plays he was going to run, but as a defensive coordinator, you got to spend at least a half a day on slash packages. And Pittsburgh rolled that thing all the way out. And so if I'm someone like New England, if you can understand that you can create a slash package where that just means more preparation. Now you might run three plays out that package. He might get 25, 30 yards and first down off of that. But it creates extra preparation time. People like Belichick can pull that the way they can pull that. They can pull that off in Green Bay. You can't pull that off in too many other places, but if you could get him convinced to do that, that was the beauty of running the slash package, is that it put extra preparation on the defense that other teams had to spend time worried about that, and they couldn't spend time working on your regular stuff.
No, I agree. You can do that. You can definitely do that. But again, you got to temper yourself. Don't ever take your starter from under center if you got Aaron Rodgers or if you got Tom Brady and put Tim Tebow under center. Ever. I feel everything you're saying, and I think you're right on as far as being able to use him in creative ways and, you know, creating problems for defenses to plan for. I got that. Just don't get too cute. That's always my, don't get too cute. Don't outthink the room. Don't outthink the room. Now, there are other issues with this. You know, Alex Smith was a little hurt because of the 49ers flirted real hard with Peyton. So Alex went and flirted with Miami real hard. But Alex Smith is winding up back in San Francisco. The news came out late today. There's still a lot of dominoes to fall. Matt Flynn goes to Seattle. David Garrard signs in Miami. Alex Smith is back with San Francisco. Tebow is in limbo. This is going to make for great sports radio. It's going to make for great TV because it's going to be interesting to see where Tim Tebow winds up because there's no telling where he's going to be. If you have a young quarterback, you don't want to bring him in. If you have a guy who's unproven at all, you don't want to bring him in because it's going to immediately – you just bought yourself a controversy. If I had to vote on a place where I like Tim Tebow to end up, I like Tim Tebow to end up in Dallas. I like Tim Tebow to end up in Philly. I like Tim Tebow to end up in Miami. Why? Because it makes for great sports radio. That's it. Tebow can't play. I'm not worried about results. But here's something I want to throw at you real quick, D. We're going to spend just give me two more minutes on this topic, and then we're going to move on. Here's something I want to throw at you about Tebow, man. Now, I was listening to Colin Cowherd earlier today, and Bill Romanowski was on it. We all know Romo's crazy. Romo says off-the-wall stuff. Romanowski said that Tim Tebow is the most famous athlete in the world. True statement or false statement? Why?
That's a false statement. You tell him to leave those pills alone. What's Romo doing? Sometimes I listen to him and I'm just like, man, you just been. He reminds me of a Gary Busey. He's just crazy.
He said Gary Busey.
He's a sports version of Gary Busey. He's just crazy. No, he's not the most famous person. Hell, Jeremy Lin was probably more famous for 2 weeks. You could argue he was as famous as Tebow for 2 weeks. Was Tebow on Sports Illustrated twice, 2 weeks in a row, and Time Magazine in a three-week period? I don't know. I don't think so. He may have been.
I don't think so.
Maybe I missed those editions. The famous people in the world. I was in China. Who did they have a picture, a portrait of in China? Kobe Bryant. Tebow, first of all, NFL is not a global sport, so he's already wrong. NFL is probably the most popular game in the United States. But if we talk about crossover games, if you talk about value in United States and globally, it's basketball. It's Kobe. I was at the World Expo in Beijing, in Shanghai. Kobe was up there. Kids are wearing Kobe jerseys. They're not wearing Tebow jerseys. They might be now, but they're not. They're not. No.
Tell Romo to leave that stuff alone. I'm telling you, it's not good for you.
Thank you. That's. I just wanted to know if I was off base. I had the same feeling about that. That's just garbage to me. It's the reason nobody wants to play in those London games. The NFL just ain't global like that.
And that's okay.
And Tebow hasn't done anything outside of his college career to really warrant being famous globally. And people abroad don't pay attention to college football.
They don't. People in Alabama do. People in Beijing, in Malaysia, no, they don't. They got them Kobe LeBron jerseys on. Keep it real, y'all. The question I want to ask you real quick, is Matt Flynn Scott Mitchell or is he Matt Schaub?
Good question. You know what, man? There's so little to draw from. I don't know what he is, man. I know he got paid.
I don't know what he is, man.
I don't know what he is. I don't know what to make of it. He had a hot game on a hot team who was on a hot streak with the best receiving core in the league. Unless he can bring those Green Bay receivers with him to Seattle, I don't know what to make of Matt Flynn. I really don't.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that.
This is what I will say, though. The fact that Miami didn't throw a bunch of money at him is a red flag.
Yeah.
His offensive coordinator is a head coach. His quarterback's coach is a head coach out there, and they don't throw a boatload of money at him. If his coach thought he was worth it, he'd have got that money in Miami. That's a red flag for me.
Yeah, that is a red. That's what I tried to say. Scott Mitchell, Pete Carroll, Scott Mitchell. just trying to send it out to him just so he can feel it. We'll see.
Yeah. Just thinking about that a little bit more, for me, that's a red flag. The fact that his own coach didn't feel that he was worth the same amount of money that he took somewhere else. Says a little bit about what that coach thinks about his talent level as far as what he can do for it. So that's why I'm going to settle in on that one for now. Now, we're going to roll into the five on the black hand side, talk a little NCAA hoops. So let's go ahead and jump into that.
Five on the black hand side.
Now, the five on the black hand side is a regular segment that we do here on Renegade Radio. We take five impressions of an event, a weekend, just things that are going on in the sports world, and we kind of just go back and forth. We take it around the horn a little bit and get our opinions on these particular five items. Starting out, impressions of the first weekend of Basketball Christmas, also known as the NCAA tournament. Impression number one, Baylor and Florida have been two unpredictable and very young and immature teams all season. Still very highly ranked, very talented, lottery picks throughout each lineup. Each team has two or three guys who are viewed as possible NBA players, possible lottery picks. But all season, they've just been struggling to find that rhythm, you know, kind of playing that AAU ball where everybody's kind of taking a turn, having a good game, but no real consistent team ball, no real consistent cohesive team concept for either of these squads. But, oh, my, look now. Both of these teams are starting to put it together, and it could be argued that either of these two teams has as much, if not more, talent than any other team in the tournament outside of North Carolina and Kentucky. And now they're picking up steam. Both teams are in the Sweet 16. Both teams seem to have an opportunity to take it pretty deep and knock off the one seed in their bracket. What are you thinking of these two teams right now, D-Will?
You know, the irony of it, I think both teams have been, you said, I think they're hitting their peak. A little bit, and they're making it happen. Was it Heslip, I want to say that he had like what 9 3-pointers? For Baylor. And you know we all know about Jones the third, and we know about Jackson as a point guard. And then I hit y'all with a text message that, you know, Billy Donovan and Izzo. It seems like they're recovering from their flirting with the NBA. That, you know, I think they lost their players for a little bit, but I think their programs, it took Donovan a little bit longer to come bounce back. But I think they're beginning to hit their stride. And his team, I feel like they have as much talent as anybody in the tournament. The irony of it is the teams they're playing are also hitting their stride. That's the irony of this, and I know we're talking about both these teams, but think about Xavier. You think about Holloway, and, you know, they had the scrap and everything else, but these cats are starting to play. And if you look at Marquette is looking crazy. So both these teams are highly talented, but in this Sweet 16 matchup, they're actually meeting up with two teams who are also hitting their stride. And I don't know, you know, these are going to be two very good matchups to watch. I like Baylor's length. I think it's hard to play against that type of length that they can put on the floor. I think we talked about last week they have, I think, five players who are, you know, over 6'9". I think sometimes in the tournament, length, you can't simulate that in practice when you get in there. And I think if they can really make that work, they can really push it far.
for them. But I think both these teams are highly talented, hitting their stride. I just think they're meeting up with two teams who are also hitting their stride.
Excellent. Now on to number two. On to the next one. Now, the emotional toll that the tournament is taking on players and coaches seems to be a little bit more intense this year. You know, the end of the Purdue game, you had visible emotion when you're talking about guys like Robbie Hummel, who's been in college since I think I was like four. When you got Majerus at the podium crying with his guys from St. Louis. You got Frank Martin having emotional moments. What do you make of this? Is it guys getting too mushy, or is it bringing forth a human element in the tournament?
I mean, to me, the one that was real emotional was Frank Martin, because his persona, when you look at it and you see him on the sidelines, is this. It almost feels like it's combative, but his kids love him, and to see the soft side of him come out in his post game speech was, I think, revealing of really what this stuff is all about and how much hours. I mean, you know, we're just on with Coach Nagy. I mean, he's on the road right now going to Minnesota. I mean, they put hours in to make this happen. I mean, we even had Bielema on last week, and he said, you know, he had 27 flights. I mean, when you just think about the hours they put in to get to that moment and how much time they spend to get to know these players and their families, you know, you can start to see that come on. You're right, that emotion, and I think that's good for the game. I think that's a side of the game that people need to hear.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, you know, we get caught up in the buzzer beaters and the last-second shots and our brackets, and we forget that, you know, this is somebody's last. For a lot of these kids, it's the last time. You know, this is the last go-around. You know, and unfortunately, in D1 basketball, there's only one team that gets to win their last game. You know, in big-time college basketball, only one team gets to win their last game, and that's the champion, or the NIT champ, but that don't really count. But for most of the seniors out there, this is it. And what you see is the culmination of a lot of hard work, a lot of sweat, a lot of bonding, a lot of team building, a lot of camaraderie. You see all of that coming to an abrupt end right in front of you. And it all makes it more captivating and more fun to watch as you ride on this emotional roller coaster with these teams and these players throughout these tournament runs. So that's another observation that you know, we had in this first weekend. Just a lot of emotion, a lot of visible emotion from players and coaches in press conferences and post games, you know, because this is the end of the road for a lot of guys.
Yep.
So moving on to number three, the most disappointing upset. For me, it was Duke. I'll tell you why. I'm going to let D. Wills give you his most disappointing upset. For me, it's the Duke Blue Devils. I don't know what it, for me, the reason this is disappointing is because I don't really know what to make of it. On one hand, you have, and this happens to Duke a lot, and what it does, it makes me question Coach K, and I know I shouldn't do that because the man is a proven excellent coach, but he always has better players than the teams he's playing against. He always has better players. So when you have the better players and you still wind up losing, did you get out coached? And this is the coach in me talking right now. This is the coach in me talking right now. If you have considerably better players than the other team, because Duke has to have better players than Lehigh. They have to. They have to. There's no way around it, right? Lehigh does not have better players than Duke. So if you have the better roster, but you wind up losing a game, as a coach, you have to look at yourself and say, I got out-coached. Not only did I get out-coached, but I got out-coached by the Lehigh coach. That's disappointing to me. There you have it. And I hate Duke because I had them going to Elite Eight and they messed up my bracket. So they're when it comes to the Game Changers bracket, if you screw me over in my bracket, and I'm going to be bracket guy for a minute and talk about my bracket. if you screw me over in my bracket, you screw the game changer over in his bracket, he puts you on 2 years probation. So for the next 2 years, they're not getting out of the round at 32. Missouri either. You're killing me, guys. You're killing me. Your turn, D.
You mentioned Missouri and Duke. I agree with you on Duke. And I'll start. I'll say, you know, for those of you of our listeners who are part of the Resistance Digital Solutions, Real Sports Guys, Tourney Challenge, you probably know that I am in first place, so I will say that. But I could be dominated even more if both Duke and Missouri played better. And what I realized is for every other team, I followed my philosophy with Duke and Missouri, I went against it. And this is why. I usually start out by asking the question, which teams can win even when they don't shoot well? And those are teams who have demonstrated that they're usually the top 2-3 in their conference defensively. And Duke, this has been well documented. Duke, this is probably Coach K's worst defensive team. But I thought what the difference was, I thought they had big men this year who would assert themselves. And they shrunk in the moment. And to me, that's the issue. And I think that goes back to coaching. I don't know if it's coaching or whatever, but this whole idea that they play a style, and I used to say this about the old Sonics with Gary Payton. They used to win 60 games a year. But it wasn't a style that was going to win in the playoffs. And when they lost to Denver in that shocker, I was like, it's supposed to happen because they don't have a game that translates well to the playoffs. And I think that's part of Duke's problem and why I've never really had them going far in many of these tournaments is because the style, they rely so much on the three, and they are shaky defensively. So when they're not playing well, they can't find a way to turn people over, to get stops. They couldn't do any of that. And that was very disappointing about the Duke team. And Missouri as well. Both those teams do not defend. And at a certain point, you got to be able to defend. That's why I like teams like Michigan State. That's why Kansas has impressed me, because they can get some stops. They can get in people, and they can impose their will on people. And Duke didn't quite do that all year long, and it just showed up. But this is a game they should have won. I mean, even with all that said, they have players good enough to win. This is a game you're supposed to win with the type of players that you have, and they just didn't deliver.
All right, number four. We're going into the second weekend. Matchups that we really like, matchups that are RSG certified. They get the RSG stamp of approval. The first matchup is Marquette versus Florida. And D. Wills kind of talked about it earlier. I talked about Florida as one of the teams that I have as being extremely hot right now. Marquette is playing some excellent basketball, though. You know, there are a couple guys in this tournament, and a guy like Jay Crowder, and then another guy that comes to mind, a guy like Draymond Green. I think they're going to be steals in the NBA. I think they're going to be 10-year NBA career type guys. And I think they're going to be on some championship teams in the league. They're guys that don't really have a position, but they're basketball. They're like the Tebow-esque in that sense that they're just good basketball players. You know, they don't really, they're not power forwards. They're not quite small forwards. They're not shooting guards. You don't know what to make of them, but damn it, they could play some basketball, and they get it done. They get it done. You know, that Tebow-esque quality of you don't really know what to make of him, but he's getting it done. You know, he looks terrible at it, but he's getting it done. He's not your prototypical quarterback. They're not your prototypical power forwards. They're not your prototypical small forwards. But damn it, these kids can play, man. Draymond Green and Jay Crowder are going to make an NBA roster next year. They're going to be very successful. They're going to make some GM look really smart. And really all he had to do was watch some of these tournament games, because Jay Crowder's really stepped it up, and he's got Marquette playing really well. Florida has Patrick Young, Mike Rosario, Bradley Beal, who's probably a top 10 pick. Patrick Young is probably an early first-round pick, maybe a lottery pick. This is going to be a heck of a game. Florida shoots the ball really well. Marquette gets out in pressures. They can attack the basket. They can guard, you know, the entire court. This is going to be a wonderful game. It's going to be up and down, high intensity, fast pace. heavy tempo. If you love basketball, if you love fast-paced, free-flowing ball, you're going to see it with this game. I'm looking forward to it. D. Will, the matchup that you're looking forward to.
Well, I think this, yeah, that Florida-Marquette game is going to be, one of those. Those are going to be money games. I think it's two, you know, great coaches. But I think we talked about Crowder. I mean, he's, what, averaging 21 points, 14 rebounds, and he's averaging 3.5 steals. I mean, can you say somebody's doing it all?
Yeah.
I mean, Marquette is just looking at – and then Holloway – for Xavier, who's just, you know, big money shot guy. I mean, those two teams, I think, are going to be great matches. But they're great matches. I mean, you think about the rematch of Kentucky against Indiana. I mean, people remember Kentucky with the game winner. I mean, Indiana with the game winner to crush Kentucky's spirit. I mean, this is
yep.
a revenge matchup that I think is just going to be battling. And, you know, Tom Crean has these guys – believing and pushing that. The point guard play is shaky. Been there, cost him. In the previous one, I was mad. That would have killed me. But I think that that's going to be. And then when you look at North Carolina State and Kansas, you know, Kansas on paper is good, but North Carolina State has just been kind of picking it up as the season's been going. And I think that, you know, they'll put some stuff together. When you look at what Howell's doing, he's averaging 15 points a game. I mean, Brown is averaging 7.5 assists, 7 rebounds, 1.5 steals. I mean, had some players who are just kind of stepping up. Robinson, you know, he's imposes well. And usually Kansas is a team that I don't think they bring the dog meter, but as I said early on, I told you Robinson is somebody that is really going to – you know, he's been doing all season, but the tournament is when you make your legend, and this guy is playing big. I mean, they had a physical game, I believe it's Purdue, and they had to really come through. So, you know, I think that there's some really good matchups, and I'm excited about this weekend.
All right, and on to number 5. Ohio has 6 Sweet 16 teams. The state of Ohio has 6 Sweet 16 teams. The Big Ten has 4 teams. You know, what does the makeup of this round of 16 say about the state of college hoops? You know, every year we try and make some assumptions and look at how the Sweet 16 is configured and kind of that should give us a snap as if that should give us a snapshot of what the last season is about or trends in college sport in college hoops in particular. What are you seeing with this particular run of things right now?
Well, I think even some of the coaches we've been interviewing, in particular, we've interviewed a number of coaches who coach teams in the upper Midwest and things like that. But all these teams, what they have in common is they place the emphasis on defense, rebounding, you know, just the defending and all that. They place the emphasis on it. If you look at all these teams, there's a similar thing that they place emphasis on getting back, and their players compete. So if you think about the teams like Cincinnati, Xavier, Ohio State, Ohio, you think about the Big Ten teams who are left, they all compete. They get after it, and they make a commitment to defense and rebounding. And these are the things that allow for you to play well when you don't shoot well, right? Because in a tournament, you play 6 games, there's going to be a game where it's not going to go in. And so how can you keep yourself in games? And I think that's a common element amongst these teams, and you know they have players who get after it. And you can see that on every one of their rosters. They have players who get after it, and so I think that's kind of a common thread that is that you can see between teams.
All right, so now we're going to get into our Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Resistance Digital Solutions. Are you tired of running to the boys in blue? Are you done with listening to sales staff trying to upsell you technology that you don't need? We've all been there. So, what did the Real Sports Guys do? We contacted Resistance Digital Solutions for all our technology needs. They are not there to meet sales quotas or make profit margins. They simply just want to sell you what you need at a fair price. From iPads to PCs to flat screens, TVs, or intricate home theater systems, they customize every solution based on your needs. Check out their website at www.resistancedigital.com or email them at sales@resistancedigital.com for your custom technology solutions today. Again, shout out to Resistance Digital for holding us down and sponsoring Dog of the Week. And as we always do about this time,
we need more dogs.
D. Wills.
Dog of the Week is John Elway. There is no other dog. He was boxed in. He had been saying all the right things, maneuvering all throughout the season. Every time he tried to get out from under Tebow Mania, the kid did something else to create something. I mean, he was, you could tell he was dying inside. And he only had one card to play. No one needed Manning more than John Elway. I mean, it was the only exit strategy he had that would not cost him politically. And I mean, Elway is the, for me, dog of the week. I mean, he pulled off what I call the Houdini trick. He slipped out of it. He's like a great boxer who's caught in the corner and just slips out of it and missed the big shot. I mean, that's Elway. Elway's my dog of the week.
And my dog of the week, in close relation, there was a close race between Elway, but I had to go with Peyton Manning. Peyton Manning solidified himself as the greatest quarterback of all time this week without throwing a pass, without calling a play, without taking one step of a drop back, without putting on a helmet, without putting on any equipment, without lacing up his shoes. He made himself the greatest quarterback in the history of the NFL. Why? Because he was able to single-handedly end Tebow Mania. Just straight shut it down. And we loved that. We loved that. It was almost like Peyton was sitting around during that time off, just like, yo, man, as soon as I get a chance, oh, I can't wait to get back on the field. I can't wait. I'm ending this Tebow stuff. I'm ending it. As soon as he got an opportunity, he said, I'm going to play it real cool. I'm going to play it coy. But in the end, I'm coming for you, Tim. I'm coming for you. Oh, man. So that's our dog of the week. You
we
know,
need
at
more
this
dogs.
Time, we always need more dogs. So get on with us next week when we do Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. So again, that's brought to you by Resistance Digital Solutions. Make sure, if you're looking for technology solutions at a fair price, make sure you check them out at www.resistancedigital.com or email them at sales@resistancedigital.com for your custom technology solutions today. All right? Now, D. Wills is going to jump in the back room, get some things rolling with our next guest, Ramogi Huma of the National College Players Association. In the meantime, I'm going to wrap with you guys for a little bit about, we're going to talk some NBA talk for the next couple of minutes while we get that interview set up. And then D. Wills is going to take that over. He's going to QB that, not Tebow style. He's going to come in and get his Matt Flynn on. You know, we just talked about Matt Flynn, but, you know, he's going to get good Matt Flynn. He's going to get that 6-touchdown Matt Flynn. NBA talk, man. This past week, trade deadline passed. A lot of small moves, no big moves, though. We've been waiting on Dwight Howard to finally figure out where he was going to wind up. Unfortunately, Dwight decided that he was going to not only stay in Orlando, but waive his opt-out option. Dumb. Extra dumb. See, Dwight Howard, if you're listening out there, and he's probably not, but I'm going to act as if he is. Dwight Howard, if you're listening out there, bro, come on, Big D. D12. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? You've been talking all this jazz about, I want to go this place. I got this list. Add this team to my list. I want to go win championships. And at the end of the day, you're going to wind up staying. And not only are you going to stay, you decided that it would be best if you waived your opportunity to make as much money as possible. Now, I'm trying to figure this out. I'm really trying to understand this. You must be seriously committed to Orlando. And I get that. I can dig that. I can understand that. But why weren't you this way all along? See, this is why we don't mess with you at RSG. This is why we don't ride for you at RSG, Dwight. You just don't bring it the way you should. You're just not hardcore the way you should be. We want our seven-footers tough. We want our seven-footers stone-faced like a king. They don't rattle. We want our seven-footers to be able to score like the Admiral. You don't give us that, my man. Not only do you don't give us that, you don't got that dog in you, man. You don't got that dog in you. You know, I don't know what to make of you right now. I don't know what to make of you. But this is what I'm going to tell you, Dwight. This goes out to you, Dwight Howard.
Be a dog. We don't need no meows. We don't need no cats. We need more dogs.
We need more dogs, man. We don't need no meows. We don't need no cats. We need more dogs. So, Dwight Howard, you want to be a dog. You want to hang with the RSG crew. You got to step your game up, son. You got to step it up. All right? You just got to bring it. That's the end of that. Game Changer had to get that off his chest. Other trades that we saw go down, Ramon Sessions to the Lakers. I think that's a good move for the Lakers. They needed to pick up a point guard. No, he's not a game breaker. No, he's not a game changer. But he upgrades that position. They didn't have to give up a whole lot. The Los Angeles Clippers picking up Nick Young. Again, iffy basketball IQ, but a good player nonetheless. Very athletic, can fill in at the two spot. Good size, fits with what they're trying to do with their up and down style. That's not a bad pickup as well. Basically, a couple month rental, and then you can decide if you're going to keep them longer than that. Other moves. Washington getting rid of Nick Young and JaVale McGee. Now, if they could just find somebody to take Andre Blatch off their hands and just totally clear the slate and let kind of John Wall grow, that'd be nice. But, you know, I give them a B grade for being able to at least move two of the knuckleheads. You know, they got the three stooges. They had the three stooges out there with those three guys. So those are some of the trades that I liked. Right now, I'm going to toss it to my man. So that's that. That's our little NBA talk for right now. Our guest is ready. D. Wills is going to jump in, and he's going to quarterback this segment again. I'm going to go out. I'm going to split out wide. We're going to run some Wildcat real quick. You know, no Tebow. Run some Wildcat, no Tebow. And I'm going to let D. Wills go ahead and run the show. You got it, man.
All right. Well, I think that, you know, what's been good, and for people who have been listening to our show for a while, we've had this constant theme that we've been talking about for at least the past 2 months, kicking off with Alan Sack, who really talked about, we were talking about the state of college sports. And our guest tonight, who has been on ESPN's Outside the Lines and many great public shows talking about this issue, I'm excited to have him on. He's the president of the National College Players Association. Has been very involved in some what I would say is potential landmark cases around this issue, and has been very vocal around kind of the rights of student athletes. And so we want to welcome to the RSG community Ramogi Huma, who is the president of the National College Players Association. Welcome to the show, Ramogi.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I want to start because I don't think people really know kind of the story and how organization was started. So can you kind of walk us through that process and how you came to even start this movement?
Sure. Well, I'm a former UCLA football player, and actually this group I started while I was still playing football at UCLA. And a couple of things happened my freshman year to drive me down that path. First was I was actually a true freshman backing up an All-American linebacker, Donnie Edwards, went on to play in the NFL for a long time.
Yeah.
Donnie was a senior, and that year, my first year, he was on a radio show similar to this talking about how fortunate he was to be on scholarship, but the fact that his scholarship didn't quite cover the basic necessities, and that that particular month he had run out of food and didn't have any money and didn't know what he was going to do about groceries. So after the show, he goes back to his apartment and finds a couple bags of groceries on his doorstep. And, he was surprised, said a little prayer, took the groceries in, and somehow the NCAA found out and suspended him. And,
wow.
You know, we were pretty frustrated in the locker room when we heard that had happened. And we understand, most players understand what the NCAA is trying to do with his rules, but at the same time, you know, Johnny was suspended. They're selling his jersey in stores across the nation, number 23, you know, and all of us could relate. You know, matter of fact, by the time Donnie had been suspended, I myself had lost 15 pounds because I went from eating 5-6 meals a day in high school to 3 meals a day in college with a meal card. But, you know, for most students, that's good enough. But when you're burning thousands of calories on the football field, it's not. And, you know, it did get down to the basics, and it was a day-to-day struggle. That kind of just came and went. You know, we felt like, you know, we didn't have a voice. UCLA said, look, we give you guys everything we can under NCAA rules, but we can't change NCAA rules by ourselves. And, you know, again, it came and went. And then later on that year, going into summer workouts, we actually had a new coach, and we had an orientation about summer workouts. And this was the time of year, they call it voluntary workouts, but they make pretty clear that it's pretty much mandatory. You know, and for the most part, players want to go get better anyways, but it's pretty clear that you got to go. Now, at the time under NCAA rules, our compliance officer stood up in the middle of orientation and said, look, if you guys get injured during these workouts, the NCAA will not allow us to pay for any of your medical expenses. You're on your own.
Wow.
And, you know, I wasn't too far removed from the recruiting process at that time. And, you know, I asked every school that offered me a scholarship. I said, well, what if I get injured? Who's going to pay for the medical expenses? And they all said they would. And come to find out, the NCAA won't even allow a school, if it wanted to, pay for medical expenses. It would have been punished. And
wow.
That was the point in time where I felt like players just needed a voice, and I started talking to some of my teammates about it. I had some friends in my high school that had gone on and played for other teams as well, and everybody was saying the same thing. So that following offseason, I started a student group. It was pretty easy at the time. It was just three people with a mission statement at UCLA can start a student group, and that's what we did.
Right.
And that developed, and now we're a nonprofit advocacy group, and we have 17,000 former and current Division I athletes from all sports, and we're the only advocacy group out there, the only voice for college athletes.
If you talk about, and I've heard you talk a little bit about the Knight Foundation's 2009 report, can you talk a little bit about the findings and what that's meaning to the work that you're doing?
Sure. I mean, when you talk about reform and changing the system, towards the top of the list, you're gonna look at the Knight Foundation and the Knight Commission. And it's a body of current and former reformists that are, you know, athletic directors, college presidents, current and former coaches and administrators. And they every 10 years or so, they have really big reports. And in 2009, they released a report talking about how tough it was to get reform done. And they actually interviewed almost all of the FBS college presidents, the top college presidents in the nation. And all of them said, yes, we need reform. And almost all of them said they were powerless to bring forth reform, and they didn't know who could bring forth reform. And that was definitely telling. It backed up everything we've been saying, that the NCAA is incapable of reforming itself, because after all, the NCAA rules are actually adopted and put in place by college presidents. And if this very group mm-hmm. is saying it doesn't have the power to reform, then who does? And
that's
for
right.
us, we've been saying, look, reform is going to come from outside pressure, from public pressure, from new laws and from the courts. And that's where we've been focusing our energy. So I think that was it definitely tells the tale in terms of where reform will come from.
One of the things that that President Emeritz kind of sent out and allowed for conferences to do is to look at kind of cost of attendance. And so this is something that, if someone who has been a college administrator, someone who's been involved in kind of the admissions and financial aid process, this is something that all students get consideration for. And I think that's something that most people who are in the media or people who talk about it don't acknowledge that
right.
cost of attendance is something we use for all colleges. So what's been the big reaction to that? Because I thought that was at least the first step. What's your feeling about that, at least that first move?
Well, and first, just to clarify for your audience, I mean, the cost of attendance is the price tag of the school, and the
yeah.
NCAA caps a so-called full scholarship below the price tag of a school. And the last several years, we've been actually doing studies showing that there's a gap between about $3,000 to $5,000 per player per year that they have to pay out-of-pocket expenses. Recently in the fall, the NCAA adopted an optional $2,000 stipend to help try to close the gap, which we thought was definitely a step in the right direction. Not enough, but a step in the right direction. Since then, the schools rose up to fight it, and it looks like they're in the process of watering it down to the point where it's not going to have much of an impact at all. Not only will it be optional, if it's approved at all, the players are going to have to jump through hoops and try to prove that they need it. Our argument is that the numbers themselves show that they need it. You know, the calculations, the scholarship falls short of the price tag of the school. That equals needs. And these guys are generating billions of dollars per year, and the schools are dragging their feet and, you know, holding on to every last penny, despite how hard it is. You know, I mean, from Donnie Edwards, my story from Donnie Edwards when I was starting out, you know, now we have in the media recent stories about something similar. You know, we have Jamar Samuels at Kansas State, who recently was about to finish his last game, walked out to in the men's basketball tournament, but they snatched him up because he had accepted $200 when he needed food as well. And yes, we understand, and we're not condoning breaking NCAA rules, but we're saying that the system is the culprit. You're going to guarantee scandals. This is going to happen all the time. The stipend would go a ways. Look, the kid didn't take $2,000. He took $200. You know, it didn't seem like it was all that egregious, you know, relative to some of the other stories. And you know, as of right now, the story is that it was actually for some basic necessities. But you know, the system turns players who are otherwise worth six figures. You know, we actually did a study with Drexel Universities. Hundreds of thousands of dollars these players are worth if they're in a fair market, but the NCAA unfairly gets the schools together, and they cap what the players can get, not even to a subsistence level, but below subsistence, below the cost of attendance. And actually, 85% of Division I athletes live below the federal poverty line by about $2,000 per year. So it's important to keep that in mind when we watch the schools drag their feet and fight an optional $2,000 stipend increase.
Yeah, and I think and for people to understand, this is how any student who comes to a college gets that. Well, if your student has a financial aid or an admissions presentation, they'll talk about the cost of attendance, which is books, pizza, and they'll say that's how we build your budget for financial aid. And so what we're talking about is just honoring what we say we do for every college student that comes to a university. So I think these are very important points to talk about. We had this, we've been talking about on our show, and I know you've talked about new revenue and how, and I want to get to some of the things that you talked about, but can you talk a little bit about, you know, what's happening with all this conference realignment and the idea that it's creating all this new revenue and, you know, what that means? Because I think people don't understand the context of, I mean, even when people talk about, you know, the educational value, people talk about not having playoffs, all these different things, but yet we have someone like Boise State who is having student-athletes fly to the Big East to play football games, you know, every Saturday, when it doesn't make sense for athletes to do that. Can you talk about what this realignment has really kind of thrown into the situation as you're talking about opportunities to rectify this problem?
Sure. I mean, I think the conference realignments, there's been nothing that has made the NCAA's priorities more clear than the conference realignments and that of their schools. It's a money grab. You know, they're breaking traditional rivalries. They're forcing their players to spend more and more hours on airplanes and buses instead of in study halls in the classroom. And they're doing it for money. And where does this money go? Where, how's it spent? Well, coincidentally or not coincidentally, it goes right back to the school and the coaches and the ADs. We have ADs right now making up to $2 million a year. Vanderbilt, their AD makes $2 million a year. And you wonder why they're willing to put these players on planes and sacrifice their education for more and more money. Now, what do players get in return? Nothing. You know, this is something for the ADs, fund money for the ADs and the coaches and the boosters, building luxury boxes in the stadiums and things like that. But, you know, when you're talking about basic necessities, health coverage and stipends and graduation rates, I mean, this is not going to help graduation rates. And if this is about education, then why would Boise State, why would San Diego State join a conference called the Big East when they're all the way out west? You know, this is, like I said, I think it's definitely showing their true colors and the fact that this is, you know, big business. And, you know, I think the NCAA has been given a lot of leeway over the years. When they want to call it educational and avoid taxes and avoid paying their players, they call it educational. When they want to go ahead and break up and realign into a conference that will make more money, they say this is a business. So I don't think they can have it both ways. I think the new money that's generated should go towards at least some of it, not all of it, just a portion should go towards basic necessities and bolstering graduation rates instead of ripping them up and ripping up protections and forcing players to sacrifice their educational opportunities even that much more.
One of the things in the Atlantic, you publish a 3-part plan to increase student-athlete compensation. Can you talk a little bit about that plan?
Sure, and I always ask the question whether or not players should get more compensation or not, or, you know, and if so, in what form. You know, it was kind of a narrow, I mean, there's a lot of issues, but in terms of compensation, definitely feel that a full scholarship should equal the cost of attendance, you know, just like an academic scholarship. The players are the ones who are generating all the money, and they're out there working hard. It's very hard to justify paying the coach, you know, $1, $2, $3, $4, $5 million a year, and then try to turn around and say, well, we don't have enough for your basic living necessities. So that's the first step. It would cost roughly, if you looked at the headcount sports for full scholarships, you're talking about men's football and basketball, it would cost a little less than $50 million a year. It's not a small chunk, but relative to the income that's being generated, especially the new income, is definitely affordable. If you were to double that and give it to female athletes in headcount sports for Title IX, you come up with about less than $100 million a year. We did a study with Drexel University showing that there's almost $800 million per year in brand new revenue coming in just from the five of the big conferences and the NCAA alone. You know, there's tons of new money right now, and that would definitely be appropriate use of it. We also advocate creating an educational lockbox for continuing education. You know, if this is about education, shouldn't the NCAA and the schools be expected to invest in education with some of these new monies? You know, especially because they're getting a tax exemption. They're not paying taxes on TV revenue. They're not paying taxes on ticket sales. Our nonprofit, the NCPA, if we were to go out and run a Moneyball tournament, we get taxed as unrelated business income. But the NCAA has been given that grace. They don't have to do that. But at the very least, they should be expected to invest in education. Why should a player who doesn't graduate after 4 or 5 years, maybe with a semester left or a year left, why should the school kick him to the curb? Why shouldn't the school open its doors and continue supporting that player until they actually achieve their degree, they earn their degree? So that's another part. And finally, I think that it's definitely hypocritical. I mentioned my teammate Donnie Edwards. They're selling his jersey in the store. He's not seeing one dime and struggling for groceries. I think if they're going to use players' images, if they're going to, you know, use players commercially to make use their games to make big TV contracts and get paid, then players should have some access to the commercial free market. And by that, I'm not saying professional salaries, but I'm saying allowing players to go ahead and do some endorsements or getting a little bit of money for the jerseys their jerseys being sold in the stores. It does not turn a player professional, you know, to capitalize on their fame. And I think kind of what I've been saying is with Reggie Bush, you know, and people have a lot of strong opinions about everything that went down. But, you know, I'm a UCLA guy. I wasn't crying too many tears when USC got busted, you know, as a alum. As a player's rights advocate, you know, I was concerned, but as an alum, I wasn't feeling too much. But I still, looking back, man, especially in the position I'm in, I feel like I'd have much rather seen Reggie Bush doing a Subway commercial than giving back the Heisman Trophy, and that's what it comes down to. Because the NCAA is trying to enforce the unenforceable, to legislate the unlegislatable. I mean, they can't legislate everything. You can't legislate weather, and you can't prevent highly valuable players from accepting money, especially when you keep them below the federal poverty line. So, you know, we're looking at ways to try to ease some of those pressures and come up with some of the solutions, not just to provide base protections, but also to root out some of the issues that are plaguing NCAA sports, like the scandals and like poor graduation rates.
You talk a lot about it. In, you know, my background, I work in higher education and value, you know, and have been a supporter of student athletics. I think there's so much that, and I think you would appreciate that, we learn from athletic experiences in terms of things that are transferable to life skills. One of the things I've been most concerned about is the inability, particularly of players in major revenue sports, to be engaged in the academic process. Is it possible? I know you talked a little about the educational lockbox, but one of the things that have you talked a little bit about rethinking
the scholarships right now. And Dr. Sack talked about this a lot. I know Alan is a good friend and colleague of yours. Talked about when things change in terms of going to these non-renewable scholarships. Can you talk about, because I think that's an important thing to talk to about a student about way back in the day, it was like you had a four-year scholarship and it wasn't year to year. Have you talked a little bit about that? Do you see that going back? What do you think about that in terms of providing that security for players?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. We actually won a pretty big victory. That's one of the things we've been fighting for the last 10 years. And you're right. Before 1973, went from 1950 to 1973, when they implemented scholarships, initially they were guaranteed for 4 years. The coaches lobbied hard against it. They wanted more control over their players. So the NCAA agreed to turn those four-year guaranteed scholarships into one-year revocable scholarships. And that's what it's been like since 1973. Now, most players don't understand that because coaches have not changed their recruiting pitch. They're still promising 4 years. They've still been promising 4 or 5 years. But the truth is that they're one-year revocable scholarships. And by that, I mean at the end of the year, a coach can refuse to renew a scholarship for any reason. We've seen players with 3.5 GPAs doing everything that they could do on the field lose their scholarships either because of an injury or a new coach comes in and they say that the player doesn't fit in their system. But they really don't need a reason. By NCAA rules, you do not have to have a reason. They just have to give you notice by June 1, and July 1, and that's how it's been. Recently, the NCAA passed a rule. Actually, when they initially approved the optional $2,000 stipend in the fall, they also approved an optional multi-year scholarship. So schools were able to give up to 4 and 5 years if they wanted to. But the minimum was still 1 year. And actually, the schools rose up against that as well. They actually took that one to a vote. And a couple weeks ago, the new rule was upheld by two votes. I mean, hundreds of schools voted. And by two votes, it survived, just to go to show where the heart of the membership is, that half of them didn't want it. Even though they weren't forced to provide four-year scholarships, it's all optional. Any school right now, although the rules survive, but if a school wants to provide just a one-year scholarship, they're free to do that. If another school wants to do 2, 3, 4 years, 5 years, that's up to them. But half the membership didn't want it. But it did survive. So I think that's definitely a good step in the right direction. There are some other issues surrounding that, because for a player who's only on 1 year or 2 year scholarship, 3 year scholarships, it's still up for renewal. They can still get rid of you for any reason. So if your school is not participating in that provision, then you might be in some trouble. And we get calls every July from players who had no idea that it could even happen in the first place. Say, how can they take my scholarship? I did everything right. But I think in terms of educational priorities, again, tax breaks, they're tax exempt for their educational mission, yet players could get fired at a drop of a hat, regardless of their academic performance. And a player who is in good standing can lose their scholarship, while a player who is academically ineligible might have their scholarship renewed. It has nothing to do with academics. It's business. And that's the reality of NCAA sports.
You're listening to Real Sports Guys. We're with Ramogi Huma, president of the National College Players Association, advocates for student-athlete rights. We definitely enjoy having you here. I want to let the game changer ask a question here. Marcus, I'll let you ask a quick question before we let Ramogi go.
I want you to touch on for a moment, I'm of the video game generation, and I've grown up playing NCAA from back in the days in the early 90s. It was Bill Walsh college football, playing college football games, playing college basketball games where, there's a guy with a Florida jersey on who happens to be wearing number 5. He has dreads, and he's 5'10 and 187 pounds. But that's supposedly, that's number 5 from Florida. That's not the actual kid. How does the whole video game piece using the likeness of college athletes play into your mission and what your organization is working towards as far as helping college players be able to have a voice in the use of their likeness and use of their abilities to make money?
That's a great question, and I mean it's ridiculous, for EA Sports and the NCAA to try to stand up and publicly pretend that those are not the exact players on those rosters. I mean, it's ridiculous. Players know it is. I know everybody knows it. That's a big reason why the fans buy the game. And players don't have any problem you know, with those entities doing that. But the problem is first of all, they're forced to give up their publicity rights to their schools. There's no option. You know, Taylor Branch, you guys might have, I think you guys have referred to him before. He wrote an article called the Cartel, an e-book, a big piece in the Atlantic, and that's the power of a cartel. If you don't sign away your publicity rights, where do you go? You're not going to play NCAA sports. So these players basically had their publicity rights stolen, you know, and they had two choices, either don't play at all or give up your publicity rights for free. And in turn, we're seeing what the schools have done with that. Supposedly, the schools are there to protect them, and the NCAA, in their words, they protect them from forces of commercialization, and they don't want players to be exploited. Well, then they turn around and exploited players by doing the same thing they said they were going to protect them from. You know, players, if the players are going to be used, they deserve a cut, period, just like any other American citizen. No American citizen should have their publicity rights stolen and used without compensation, and players are the only group in America where that's happening to. So we're looking forward to the conclusion of that Ed O'Bannon case. Ed O'Bannon from UCLA, proud of him, UCLA alum, going after the NCAA sports for doing that, and he could change it for every athlete in the nation.
Well, that's right. Ramogi Huma, the president of the National College Players Association. Ramogi, we enjoy having you here. Hopefully you'll come back and be
anytime.
A part of this. We'd love to talk to you more about it, and thank you for being here.
All right, thanks for having me.
Game changer, going back to you.
All right, again, thanks again to Ramogi Huma for joining us this week. Greatly appreciate it. Tons of insight. You know, it's an issue that is close to our hearts. You know, I played at NCAA Sports, not Division I. Devon played NCAA Sports, not Division I. And PhD played NCAA Sports, although not Division I. But at the same time, given that we weren't under the demands of a traditional D1 athlete, a big-time NCAA revenue-generating sport athlete, we had a different experience as student athletes. And I think our experiences are more in line with what everybody thinks of when they talk about being a true student athlete. And because of that, we have a different perspective on what Division I student athletes are missing by not being able to truly develop as people, develop as individuals. I have siblings who were Division I athletes. Devon has, you know, knows tons of people who, from his community, his neighborhood, who are Division I athletes. Same with PhD. And for us, this is an issue that always hits close to home because it is, you know, athletics is something that you only get to do for a certain amount of time. And to see entities, colleges making tons of money off of these young men, and them being penalized for trying to benefit from it, to me is a bit of a contradictory dynamic given the educational mission of most institutions.
Yeah,
so,
and a game changer I want to add is that, you know, what you can always also sense from Ramogi, what people miss the fact that folks are still fans. You know, Alan Sack, Ramogi, these folks are still fans of sports. They're still there, but they're fighting for rights. And so I don't want people confused that folks are not fans because they're questioning the system. These are still folks who love the game, and that's why they're questioning.
Yeah, I agree. So as we go into the portion of the show we like to call the shutdown, this is where we're going to shut it down. At this part of the show, I want D-Wheels to name out a bit of whackness. We here at RSU, we're going to stamp out all the whackness in the sports world. So, D-Wheels, something that was whack to you this week, I want you to just shut it down real quick as we get into the shutdown. So go ahead. What you got?
To me, what was whack this week was all the hype around Tebow. Because it wasn't about Tebow. This was all about Manny. And folks, we gonna shut it down like it's been never shut down before, that eliteness will always win out. People know when they see the real thing, they do the eyeball test, and at the end of the day, it's about eliteness. It's not about potential. It's about can you deliver. That's what it's about.
All right, my shutdown of the week, I'm shutting down the whole Derek Fisher talk. Derek Fisher's 36 years old, man. He's a great locker room guy, but that's about all he's going to give you. I'm shutting
that's
down
right.
talking about Derek Fisher changing the contender. It's not going to happen. But anyway, check us out here next week, RSG Renegade Radio, and then we'll have another great show lined up for you. Next week, our guests will include Tamika Randall, coach for the Women's Ohio program. She's going to stop in and talk with us. We have other guests lined up. Be ready. Be on the lookout for what we got lined up for you on Facebook. RSG out.